the first such arrangement ever made by the country. But officials said they'd be watching him. Any missteps, and he was finished. Any breaches of trust, and he would be gone. In less than 2 years, Bowden located and identified the wrecks of two Spanish galleons in Samana Bay, the Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, and just 8 miles away, the Conde de Tolosa. The ships carried more than 1,200 passengers and crew between them, many of whom had planned to make lives abroad. Most had converted their worldly possessions into gold, jewelry, and coins, which traveled easily along with their dreams. After Bowden found the wrecks, much of their treasure became his. In 1979, National Geographic ran a 26-page feature, Graveyard of the Quicksilver Galleons, about his work. Penned by famed marine historian Mendel Peterson, the piece took readers underwater with Bowden and showed, in glorious color, what a man could find if only he threw over his life to go look. It included a gold medallion bearing the cross of the Order of Santiago, framed by 24 diamonds, which Peterson later called the greatest artifact ever pulled from the sea. Matera had read the National Geographic story as a teenager, imagining himself as Bowden. Many presumed Bowden to be in it for the money, but he seldom sold what he found. He told people he was chasing a feeling, the moment when, after years of struggle, and after 1,000 people say you're crazy, you see something sparkle in the water and grab onto it. Treasure. A person is never the same after that. Bowden worked his lease area for the next several years, doing groundbreaking work on the 18th-century French warship Scipion and other important wrecks, but often finding nothing at all. That didn't stop others from envying his life, one in which they imagined him cruising the Caribbean, wind in hair and cognac in hand, in search of the next lost treasure. Few thought about the life he lived every day. He was away from home almost all the time, which made a normal existence impossible, and his marriage a challenge. It was hard for him to have a meaningful conversation about his job. Almost no one in the world did what he did, or could even imagine it. Even the treasure itself had a tragic patina. Much of it came from wrecks in which people had died violently at sea. Still, he could not dream of doing anything else, so he kept working, and in the late 1980s, he struck again, this time on Concepcion, one of the greatest treasure wrecks of them all. William Phipps had arrived there first in 1687 and cleaned out as much of the ship's silver as 17th century technology allowed. Soon the wreck became lost to the ages, and it stayed lost for almost 300 years, until Jack Haskins's research helped lead treasure hunter Bert Weber to the wreck in 1978, in an area about 80 miles offshore dubbed the Silver Bank. Weber salvaged what he could, after which the government awarded the rights, briefly, to Carl Fismer, and then to Bowden. Although he hadn't found the wreck, Bowden's touch on it made all the difference. Soon, Concepcion was showing more of her silver, thousands of coins worth millions of dollars that no one had seen since 1641. But it came at a lonely price. Radios and television didn't work in the Silver Bank. There were no movies or videos aboard Bowden's salvage vessel, just old newspapers. No one could get away for a jog or even a smoke by themselves. During these 2-week trips, over and over again for years, it was just 8 or 9 men together on a 65-foot boat, alone and crowded, inescapably, all at once. And that was just during the day. At night, it became difficult for Bowden to push away the idea that he was anchored over a mass gravesite. More than 300 people had perished aboard Concepcion, along with countless others who had died nearby in ships broken by the Silver Bank through the ages. Sometimes he would awaken at 2 or 3 in the morning to go out and check his boat's lines, not because he believed they hadn't been tied well, but because he knew anything could happen out there, especially on moonless nights. On one trip, an elderly investor who'd come along shook Bowden awake in the middle of the night.
"Tracy," he said, "I was standing on the back deck. I heard voices. I heard so many voices.
Bowden told him to keep away from the railings, but didn't argue with the man.
Most of these ships wrecked in hurricanes, Bowden told him. I can't imagine what those people went through.
For years, Bowden kept working the Concepcion, bringing up silver and selling little of it, fighting off hurricanes and solitude. Filmmakers put him in documentaries. His artifacts went into museums. In 1996, National Geographic ran another feature, this one written by Bowden himself, about his experiences on the Concepcion. And he kept working the galleon, taking treasure and artifacts others could never reach. He thought a lot about Phipps during those long stretches out on the Silver Bank, about what it meant for an ordinary guy to go after something great. Bowden could have told these stories to Matera for hours, but he stopped himself.
I've taken too much of your time already, John, he said. What I really wanted to say is that I hope we can all stay friends.
Chatterton spent the next several days reading books about the conquistadors, especially Francisco Pizarro, who showed up in Peru with fewer than 200 men and vanquished thousands of the enemy, an empire seized in moments. At the same time, Matera typed up ads to place in scuba diving magazines on behalf of Pirate's Cove, his once thriving dive charter business. It was time, he told Carolina, to face reality. The Golden Fleece likely would never be found, not because it wasn't there, but because his partners couldn't come together. Chatterton seemed to have lost patience with Bowden, the search for the pirate ship, and the Dominican Republic. Bowden also appeared to have lost patience with Chatterton, with him, with their crazy ideas. So, Matera had come to his senses. By reviving Pirate's Cove, he could do what he'd originally intended, support himself in a Caribbean paradise by taking high-end clients to storied and beautiful shipwrecks. He awoke 3 hours later than usual the next morning. He didn't shave or brush his teeth. He just sat at the kitchen table, reading about the New York Mets on his laptop and eating his bowl of cold cereal. Finally, he drove back to Samana, where he was to meet Chatterton for dinner. But what kind of dinner would it be? Without crew, notebooks, or placemat diagrams, all that was left was the pizza at Fabio's. And a person didn't drive to the tip of nowhere for that. Still, he went. A few hours later, when he reached cell phone coverage, he received a voicemail from Bowden, who said he'd thought things over and wanted to further salvage the sugar wreck. They would work for 2 weeks, the typical salvage cycle, and discover what they could. To Matera, it seemed like a miracle. This was what he and Chatterton wanted most of all. He dialed his partner as fast as he could. The two men made a plan on the phone. They would do a detailed side-scan sonar and magnetometer survey of the sugar wreck, then salvage as many artifacts from the debris field as possible, looking for anything that would confirm the ship's identity as the Golden Fleece. If they found so much as a coin or pottery shard or anything newer than 1686, the year of the pirate ship's sinking, they would rule out the sugar wreck as Bannister's ship. But neither expected that. Work began in earnest on the sugar wreck site several days later. Chatterton and Matera scanned and magged the area, making detailed maps Bowden could use to pinpoint the search. Salvage began shortly thereafter. Bowden joined the men for the work. From the start, the mood was collegial, especially between Chatterton and Bowden. Over the next week, crews pulled up hundreds of artifacts from under the muddy bottom, many of them pristine muskets, knives, a broadsword with bone handle, jugs, Delftware china, Madeira wine bottles, and cannonballs. Each piece seemed more impressive than the last, not just for its delicate beauty, but for its age. Not one dated later than 1686. At night, the two partners relaxed at the villa, looking out over the worksite. In the distance, a great sailing ship appeared, her white sails stretching into the sky. The men watched her draw closer until she'd entered the mouth of the channel. She was perhaps 100 feet long, about the size of the Golden Fleece, and she maneuvered beautifully in this tight space. She anchored just past the island and parallel to the bridge, likely to resupply and take on freshwater, just as ships had for centuries here. To Chatterton and Matera, the ship seemed a gift, a demonstration of all they'd believed. A ship of her size could come here after all, if only her captain had vision. The 2-week salvage operation on the sugar wreck concluded a few days later. While crews pulled gear from the water, Chatterton and Matera asked Bowden for his opinion. Was the sugar wreck the Golden Fleece? Bowden told them that while all the artifacts were period to the Golden Fleece, the fact that the wreck was off the island and not in a careening place, and especially that the wreck was too deep, continued to trouble him. For those reasons, he still needed to be certain the pirate ship wasn't at Cayo Levantado before doing more work on the sugar wreck. Chatterton walked away. Matera looked straight into Bowden's eyes. Tracy, you know that people are looking to steal this wreck from you, and you know the government wants to cut down everyone's leases. You can really help yourself by notifying Cultura you found the pirate ship. The wreck's not at Levantado, it's right here. But Bowden held firm. A few days later, Chatterton was back in Maine making arrangements to dive real shipwrecks, getting to be John Chatterton again. Matera flew back to the States too, showing up at a gun range in Pennsylvania, shooting at targets long after they'd shredded and stopped being targets anymore. A month passed that way. Then, in early December 2008, Matera received a phone call from Bowden reporting news from Cultura. An archaeologist had found the Golden Fleece at Cayo Levantado. Chapter 14. Drifting Away. Bowden sounded shaken on the phone, but this was his information. A report had been filed at the lab in Santo Domingo by a Dominican-based archaeologist who had long researched shipwrecks and even hunted treasure in the country. Not only had he found the Golden Fleece at Cayo Levantado, he'd supplied the precise location. Matera went nauseous. He swore to Bowden that the discovery was impossible, that he and Chatterton had gone over every square foot around Cayo Levantado, but mostly his mind was swimming, searching the area all over again, dragging the magnetometer across Levantado and all that was fair in the world, telling himself it was inconceivable that he and Chatterton had found everything at the island but the one thing that mattered. Matera asked if he could get the location the archaeologists had supplied. In a barely audible voice, Bowden said he would try. Matera's next call was to Chatterton. He laid out the facts as he knew them. Chatterton asked how fast Matera could get to Miami International Airport. Why? Matera said. So we can go back and prove this is bullshit. On the airplane, Chatterton and Matera analyzed the development. Neither had expected an archaeologist to take a shot at the Golden Fleece, and yet it made sense. By making this discovery, the man could make a case in the name of academia for the Dominican government to grant him salvage rights over Bowden. He had a fine reputation. No doubt he would contribute artifacts to a museum or a university to justify his claim jump. The rest of the flight was spent trying to figure out where on the island the archaeologist had made his discovery, trying to imagine a spot they had missed. Every few minutes, one of the men would ask, "Did this son of a bitch really find it?" And the other would answer, "No way." They sat down with Bowden later that day in Santo Domingo. He looked worn, but he came with important information. The place where the archaeologist had reportedly found the Golden Fleece. The man hadn't supplied any GPS coordinates, just a photograph and a description of an area at Cayo Levantado near the western beach. But that was enough for Chatterton and Matera. They recognized the location. There was nothing there. "Give us a few days," Matera said. "We'll prove it." Before Bowden could object, Chatterton and Matera were out the door and on their way to Samana, ready to shoot down the archaeologist's claim. On the road to Samana, Chatterton and Matera received a call from Garcia Alaconte, who had spoken to a government contact. The new claim was putting pressure on Cultura to seize the Golden Fleece from Bowden and declare it an archaeological site, wherever she happened to lie. Officials now understood the rarity and significance of Bannister's ship, and believed the wreck might be better curated by an academic than by treasure hunters. Chatterton and Matera had feared these days were coming, when politicians and armchair wannabes elbowed in and stole treasure from real guys who worked the waters every day. And there was more bad news. As Garcia Alacon understood it, the push was intensifying now at Cultura to cut down the size of Bowden's lease area. Indeed, the agency had taken similar action recently against another leaseholder and appeared ready to do it to every treasure hunter working in country. By putting more salvers to work over smaller areas, Cultura could expect better production, along with increased lease payments. There was no telling which areas they would seize first.
"So what do we do?" Matera asked.
Garcia Alacon had no answer, just an opinion. "Get to Cayo Levantado and deliver the strongest possible proof that the pirate ship was not where the archaeologists claimed it to be. The longer the lab believed it was there, the more likely they were to take it from Bowden. And then, none of the rest would matter."
"We're on the road, Victor," Matera said. "We're already going as fast as we can."
The next morning, Chatterton, Matera, Kretschmer, and Ehrenberg took the deep explorer to Cayo Levantado, wondering how they would live with themselves if someone else had found a pirate ship in a place they'd sworn it could never be. Chatterton slowed the engine as the boat settled near the westerly end of the island. He navigated the rest of the way by using the photograph Bowden had supplied, trying to match the image to the island, calling out directions to Kretschmer at the wheel. They finally reached the spot, a place a couple hundred yards offshore, and dropped anchor. Ehrenberg reviewed the team's data files on his laptop. Months earlier, they'd surveyed the entire area and found no targets, and therefore no shipwreck. Still, they pulled on their dive gear to make sure. They set up a grid and searched the bottom, visually and with metal detectors. Methodically. And again. They found ceramic bricks and pieces of wood, all of which came from a shipwreck that was centuries old. But no one worried about that. They'd discovered these remnants months ago during one of their surveys of the island. By shape and dimensions, the pieces couldn't have belonged to a ship larger than one-third of the Golden Fleece. This was the wreck of a 16th or 17th century island hopper, not a great sailing vessel built to cross oceans and carry 100 pirates. Back on the boat, the team made a plan. They would send a report to the lab, including photographs, bathymetric surveys, magnetometer histories, and multicolored sonar images, an account so thorough it would rule out the site for good. Heading back to the villa, the men got to thinking. There was no guarantee that Cultura would accept their proof that the archaeologist was wrong. Even if it did, other salvers or academics or treasure hunters were likely to follow with their own claims to the Golden Fleece. To Chatterton and Matera, it made sense for rivals to show up now, as word must have leaked that Bowden was hot on the pirate ship's trail. If enough rivals made similar claims, even if those claims were bullshit, Cultura could take the wreck from Bowden. The only defense was to find the Golden Fleece, and the best shot to do that was to convince Bowden to finish salvage at the sugar wreck site, and to do it now. If there was smoking gun evidence still under the mud, they would find it. Matera called Bowden, assuring him that the archaeologist's report could not be correct, and imploring him to further salvage the sugar wreck site. Bowden seemed buoyed, but still concerned that others might descend on Cayo Levantado, looking to claim the Golden Fleece. "Exactly," Matera said, "which is why you have to act now." Bowden agreed that action had to be taken, but he wanted Chatterton and Matera back at Cayo Levantado. Matera's neck tightened so quickly his vision blurred. "This is really bad, Tracy. There's no way Chatterton is going back to that island."
"He's a hothead."
"I'm not going to listen to that anymore," Matera said. "Chatterton is my partner. You need to forget Levantado." But Bowden didn't sound like he was going to forget the island. When they hung up, Matera could only think, "He's lost confidence in us. He doesn't believe in us anymore." That afternoon, at Fabio's, Matera told Chatterton about the call. He expected his partner to explode or storm out or to call Bowden and scream or quit. But it was worse than that. Chatterton just sat there, eating his pizza, looking through Matera and out onto the street. Minutes passed this way, each longer than the last, until a familiar sound came from the television in the corner of the restaurant. Only now did Chatterton glance up to see himself starring in an episode of Deep Sea Detectives, the History Channel television series about two divers who solve shipwreck mysteries around the world. And he watched it, not because he enjoyed seeing himself on the screen, but because every one of the shows he'd filmed had an ending that made sense. Chatterton called Matera's cell phone late that evening. He said he'd given up on Bowden, but could not put up with the idea of poachers stealing something they hadn't worked for, something they were incapable of finding themselves. And yet, that's likely what was coming now that word was out that Tracy Bowden was after the Golden Fleece. One morning after Ehrenberg lost data on the computer, Chatterton exploded, accusing his friend and roommate of slovenly work and an unfocused mind. "Screw this guy, I'm going home. It's not worth it," Ehrenberg told Matera. "I don't get paid, my payoff doesn't come until we find something. And we sure as hell aren't finding treasure now. I don't need this." Before Chatterton could throw Ehrenberg over the villa's balcony, Matera stepped between them, pulling the usually easygoing Ehrenberg aside and urging him to stay. Ehrenberg went inside to cool off. Chatterton followed him a few minutes later, and the men shook hands. But the peace was short-lived. That afternoon, Chatterton lit into Kretschmer for requesting time off to spend with family. "Now?" Chatterton yelled. "Are you fucking kidding me, Heiko?" "You know what, John?" Kretschmer said. "I'm done. I have a job waiting for me at the oil refinery. It's a steady job. It pays. I'm leaving." Again, Matera jumped in, asking Kretschmer to stay on, but Kretschmer shook his head. His nights were tortured by mosquitoes, there was no internet or hot water in his apartment, he missed his family, and he had an offer for a good job. No crazy bosses. Matera couldn't afford to lose Kretschmer any more than he could Ehrenberg. Kretschmer fixed everything, was the first to work in the morning and the last to leave at night, and was one of the nicest, easiest guys Matera had known. "You gotta take the good with the bad with Chatterton," Matera said. "He and I have different styles, but he gets more out of people than anyone in the world. He gets things done." "He's making me crazy," Kretschmer said. "He's making me crazy too," Matera replied. "But we gotta remember that this son of a bitch is the one who's gonna help us make history. He squeezes more out of a 3-week operation than most guys could in a year. You have to agree with that, Heiko." Kretschmer nodded. "If you leave, we're done," Matera said. "Worse than that, I lose a good friend because I'll have to kill you. So stay." Kretschmer took a breath and began to laugh. "Okay," he said. "For you, I stay." Lying in bed that evening, sweating because the air conditioning had died, Matera opened a book he'd read twice already. Benedict Arnold's Navy, about the American general's stand against a British fleet on Lake Champlain in 1776. He read into the night, worried for Arnold, a hero in America's greatest year, and the coming decision that would ruin the good life that Arnold had made. It was now just a week before Christmas, and no one had to say it. They needed a break from this place, from this search, from one another. So they decided to go home to spend time with families and do things that counted. No one believed other salvors would show up at Cayo Levantado during the holidays. That's not how the lazy worked. It took more than 20 hours for Chatterton to travel from Samana back to Maine. When he got home, he kissed his wife, fell onto his living room couch, and marveled at how every light and appliance and toilet just worked. He went scallop diving off the rocky coast behind his backyard, stacked wood for his fireplace, and selected the right bottle of wine. At night he lay silent in bed, unplagued by mosquitoes and sweat. He took long, hot showers in the mornings. Only after Christmas, when Chatterton had been home for a week, did Carla ask, "So, where's our pirate?" Of course, she knew he hadn't found Bannister yet, and she didn't mind. He'd loved that about her since they met. She'd never complained about his work, the travel, the time away from home, the danger. Never asked him to be who he wasn't. But now he could see that his life was wearing on her. More than once during the search for the pirate ship, Carla had said, "You work all the time." And it was true. He was hardly home anymore. But any less effort and he'd lose the Golden Fleece. Every day he wanted to tell Carla he didn't need this bullshit in the Dominican Republic anymore, that his decision to hunt pirates and treasure now seemed a mistake, that he couldn't believe the choices he'd made at a stage in his life when days, never mind years, couldn't be thrown away. But what good would whining do? Instead, he just told her that it's one thing to go up against the ocean, if the ocean beats you, okay, but to be held back by a stubborn old man? That's not how the world should work. The crowd was lively for Chatterton's talk at a Northeast dive shop, and he did not disappoint. Jumping into his story about finding the mystery U-boat, he gestured with his hands to describe his first moments inside the lost German sub, and twisted his body to show how he'd slithered out with his life. At the end, people lined up to have him sign books, DVD covers, and T-shirts. They asked his advice and told him he'd been an inspiration. Time went fast for Chatterton here. At home, he received a phone call from Terry Kirby, the director at the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory. Kirby had an idea for a television documentary, an investigation into whether a two-man Japanese midget submarine had fired torpedoes at the battleship USS Arizona during the attack on Pearl Harbor. To Chatterton, the idea was a winner. It had everything he loved, history, mystery, and deep diving, and an ending. He thought it perfect for PBS and its documentary series, Nova, which he'd been a part of before. "Sounds like a great project, Terry. Let me get back to you." On New Year's Eve, Carla made a dinner at home for their closest friends, including Diana Norwood, the widow of Chatterton's former co-host on Deep Sea Detectives. She served a Stilton cheese, a whole Arctic char, and homemade cheesecake with fresh Maine blueberry glaze. It was the kind of meal Chatterton dreamed about when he was in Samana. Not long afterward, Chatterton and Carla went to an event for an organization that introduced badly wounded and disabled veterans to scuba diving. The group would be exploring a shipwreck in the Caribbean. As a Vietnam combat veteran, Chatterton felt honored to contribute. On the dive boat, he geared up with the other veterans. He worried about how he might help them underwater and rehearsed rescue scenarios in his head. The group was led into the water by another dive instructor, Chatterton bringing up the rear. His attention soon turned to a young man, paralyzed below the waist, who strained with his arms to pull himself through the water. By the time he reached the wreck, he was nearly exhausted. Chatterton signaled to ask if the diver wanted to return to the surface, but could see in the man's eyes he didn't want to give up, so Chatterton followed him inside the wreck. Unable to kick, the man reached for a piece of railing and began pulling himself along, and when he ran out of railing, he grabbed pipes or door frames, and in this way, he began to streak through the ship, free and powerful and faster than even Chatterton could swim. By using the wreck to propel himself, the man now darted through passageways and corridors. When Chatterton finally caught up to him, he saw pride in the young guy's eyes, and he remembered what it felt like when a person found a way to do something that looked impossible to do. In Santo Domingo, Matera booked new reservations for his dive center. Each transaction was pleasant, just a phone call, a date on the calendar, and a thanks. He took beach walks in the mornings, smoked Cohiba cigars in the afternoon, ate dinner with Carolina by candlelight. Not once did his fiancée lose her temper or curse Tracy Bowden or wish the entire country to be swallowed by the sea. Perhaps she didn't realize the spectacular extent to which he and Chatterton were failing. Sometimes Matera's thoughts drifted back to the galleons, and he wondered if he might have found treasure by now if he and Chatterton hadn't detoured to go look for the pirate ship. One morning he called Francisco, a dive instructor he knew, and invited him to the Santo Domingo Harbor, just down the road from his apartment. For years, Matera had heard stories about galleons that had sunk while tied up in the harbor. He'd even gone diving there once before. Now, on a whim, he went back to check the place out. At the mouth of the Ozama River, the men pulled on their wetsuits, Just a few yards away, cars and trucks flew past on the Paseo Presidente Biglini, horns blaring and lights flashing as drivers hurried to everywhere. As the vehicles passed, Matera wondered how many of them might imagine a 400-year-old galleon sunk here, silent for centuries under this city of fast-moving lives. Soon, he and Francisco had descended 20 feet to the bottom. Sand and particulate mushroomed up from the floor, making it impossible for either man to see more than a few yards in front of his mask. It took just a minute before they lost sight of each other. Matera began to sweep his metal detector over the bottom, listening for the sounds of treasure. What might it be like, he wondered, to find a gold coin down here? Would he be able to read the date? Would it shine? Matera stopped. Ahead, he could see the faint outline of a massive object, brownish and heavy, moving toward him, slowly, but definitely as if aimed. As the object drew closer, it appeared to be an ancient wood timber of the kind he'd seen in his books about galleons. He swam toward the object and reached for it. Here was his treasure. But when his hands arrived, they took hold of a face. There was a face on this object, and holes where there once had been eyes. And in a moment, the thing crashed over Matera, tearing the regulator from his mouth and sending him sprawling. And as he screamed into the water, he could see that this wooden timber was really a horse, drowned and decomposing and floating out to the Caribbean Sea. When Matera surfaced, his first instinct was to call Chatterton, who loved this kind of story, but he stopped himself. He worried that it would sound like he was drifting away from their pirate project, and worse, he worried that it was true. Chapter 15. Drowning. When the men returned to Samana in early January 2009, Chatterton learned that Matera had booked more customers for the dive center. In a tone and volume Matera didn't appreciate, Chatterton accused him of losing focus on the only thing that mattered, the pirate wreck. But when Matera asked for a better idea about how to make use of their time, Chatterton couldn't answer. That afternoon, Matera received a phone call from Kretschmer. A salvage boat belonging to Bert Weber, one of treasure hunting's biggest names, was maneuvering off Cayo Levantado. It wasn't clear what the vessel was doing there, but to Kretschmer it looked suspicious. Matera collected Chatterton and Ehrenberg and full-throttled it out to the island. They found Weber's crew anchored over the same site that the archaeologist had provided to Cultura, the site they had just ruled out. It enraged both Chatterton and Matera, but things got worse. As they drew closer, they could see divers in the water. "Let's fucking ram their boat," Chatterton said. Matera wasn't sure if he was kidding. Either way, it was clear to him that Weber's men had arrived to claim that they'd found the Golden Fleece, or at least were close. That alone might prompt Cultura to wrest salvage rights from Bowden and award it to Weber, another old-time great who had deep pockets and a first-rate crew. Chatterton steered the boat closer to Weber's. Drawing to within 100 feet, he lined up a straight shot and reached for the throttle. He looked at Matera, then, slowly, he reached for a different weapon, his cell phone, and began shooting photographs. He emailed the pictures to Bowden, then followed up with a call. Bowden didn't like what he heard. He told Chatterton he worried that Weber's crew might be onto something at Cayo Levantado. "These are Fugazi numbers," Chatterton said. "The wreck's not there." But that left the matter of why Weber, or anyone else, might be anchored over the archaeologist's site. To Chatterton, the answer was simple. Buzz. Word was out that Bowden was hot after the Golden Fleece. Anyone who could make it look like they were contributing to finding the wreck might petition Cultura to award them some, or even all, of the salvage rights. If they found so much as a piece of shitty old wood, and there were mountains of them sunk around Cayo Levantado, their case would appear even stronger. If they had investors, even a rumor that they might get the Golden Fleece could bump their stock price. "I don't know Weber's motives," Chatterton told Bowden. "Maybe his guys are just out for a swim and a suntan, but you need to get him the hell out of here." Bowden called Kultura. Officials there said Weber had been granted permission to test equipment in the area. But when Bowden asked why Weber might be over the same spot where the archaeologist reported finding the Golden Fleece, his contact could only say he would look into it. That evening, Matera drove to Santo Domingo to buy supplies. Chatterton went with Kretschmer and Ehrenberg for dinner at Tony's. There they saw several members of Weber's crew at a table drinking beer. Just the sight of these men irked Chatterton. Even his favorite local restaurant wasn't off limits to intruders. Chatterton sat down with his back to a wall in a place where he could see the entire restaurant. One of Weber's crew called out to Chatterton's table.
Treasure pussies!
Chatterton just stared at the men. Another of Weber's crew called to him.
What are you looking at, asshole?
Fuck you, Chatterton said.
I should come over and kick your fucking ass, another one called out.
Come on over, Chatterton said. He looked to Ehrenberg and Kretschmer. They were two of the smartest and most capable men he knew. They had options in life. They weren't making much money here, and conditions were difficult, and they certainly weren't bar fighters. But both of them clenched their fists and pushed their chairs back from the table, ready to rumble. They were all in this together. They're drunk. We're not, Chatterton said. We're carrying guns. They're holding their dicks. Seriously, who's got the advantage here? If they make a move, I'm going to beat the crap out of them with my Smith and Wesson. And then it became clear to Chatterton. If the other crew provoked a fight, it gave them a claim against Bowden. He could hear them now crying to Kultura.
Bowden's rogues attacked me in a fine dining establishment.
So he and his guys could not be the ones to make the first move. We're going to sit here and eat our dinner, Chatterton told Kretschmer and Ehrenberg. But if they come over, we got to do what we got to do. But no one came over. Finally, Weber's crew left, mumbling tough as they walked onto the street. They talk like Popeye, Chatterton said, but inside they're all olive oil. Everyone laughed. The crisis had been averted. But no one slept well that night. If Weber's boat was still at Cayo Levantado the next morning, it would be a strong indication that Kultura had endorsed his presence and dismissed Bowden's complaint. If it was gone, the area still belonged, however tenuously, to Bowden. The men went out at sunrise. Matera steered while Chatterton stood at the rail on the side, binoculars in hand, looking for interlopers. He spotted a boat just off the western beach at Cayo Levantado.
Son of a bitch, Matera yelled.
He gunned the engines.
You don't come into another guy's house and take his stuff.
Peering through binoculars, Chatterton put up his hand and called for Matera to slow down.
It ain't Weber, he said.
Matera cut power. As the boat settled, Chatterton got a steadier view of the offender. She was a university vessel they knew, doing research on whales. Weber's boat was gone. The men returned to their storage shed beneath the villa, doing maintenance and repairs, waiting for Bowden to come to his senses and finish salvaging the sugar wreck. The next morning, Matera received a call from a fisherman friend who reported that there was a new salvage boat anchored off the western beach at Cayo Levantado, one the locals hadn't seen before. Matera and the others rushed to the island. Anchored over the archaeologist's site and where Weber's crew had just been working, was a vessel belonging to American salvers Bowden had put to work on a different wreck. Matera cut hard to the left and maneuvered until his boat was cheek to cheek with the other. Standing on the bow, Chatterton called to their crew. To Matera, he looked like a 17th-century pirate ready to board a merchant vessel.
"What in the hell are you doing here?" Chatterton yelled.
"We're diving a wreck," said one of the men.
"I know you're diving a wreck. The question is, why are you diving a wreck in our area?"
The captain stepped forward. Chatterton remembered being introduced to him by Bowden and disliking him.
"I am a citizen of the city of Samana," the man said, "and I can dive wherever I want. Besides, we have permission. You better talk to Bowden."
That statement slammed Chatterton. What if Bowden had sent this crew to search for the Golden Fleece? What if he'd told them to survey the area and find the pirate ship? If that was the case, Chatterton and Matera were already out. Bowden just hadn't told them yet. Matera dialed Bowden by cell phone but got no answer. For now, he and Chatterton were helpless to do anything about this new crew. They were just diving, and there was no law against that. Matera dropped anchor and parked just off the invading boat's bow, waiting to hear back from Bowden. When Bowden finally called back, Matera told him about the new crew and asked him straight out, "Did you send these guys out here?"
"Let me take care of it," Bowden said.
"Did you send them?"
"No, but I'll take care of it."
Matera ended the call. Chatterton asked if he thought Bowden was behind the new crew.
"He said he wasn't," Matera said, "but I don't know."
Chatterton and Matera could do little more than watch the rival divers. It was bad enough that these invaders wanted to cash in on others' hard work. It was worse that they didn't care anything about Bannister, a man who'd never have wanted to be found by men like them. The new vessel left a few hours later. Things were clear now. Word was out about the Golden Fleece. Everyone wanted a piece, and more would be coming. If Bowden didn't claim the pirate ship soon, it was just a matter of time before Kultura awarded rights to the wreck, or to the area, to one or more of these late intruders. But now it seemed obvious to them that Bowden wouldn't budge. He wanted them to return to Cayo Levantado. And then, at dinner that night, Chatterton and Matera conceived a simple and powerful solution to the entire problem. Rather than wait for Bowden to finish work on the sugar wreck, they would do it themselves, without asking, looking for any artifact that would prove the wreck to be the Golden Fleece, a smoking gun. Half the world already seemed to be looking for the pirate ship without permission. Why couldn't the guys who actually put in the hard work and spent money and put their families on hold get an unimpeded shot at the wreck, too? They would go the next morning. But when they awoke, no one made a move for the boat. In their excitement, neither man had considered that Bowden might see this as mutiny, or that Kultura might consider it an affront, or, most of all, that it wasn't an honorable thing to do. But they couldn't return to Cayo Levantado either. They tried to think of something constructive to do, something better than just wasting time. For a few days, they drove their boat around the bay, looking for nothing in particular. Then, one morning, they just didn't go out. Fuel was too expensive, or another pump needed fixing, or it rained. Chatterton had business to do in the States. Matera had his dive center to run. Ehrenberg needed a break. Kretschmer wanted to visit family. "See you guys soon," they said to one another, but to each of them, it sounded like goodbye. In Maine, Chatterton spoke to his friends in the television business. Every project they discussed sounded promising. He checked his portfolio. He was already into his treasure-hunting adventure for several $100,000, a serious dent to his net worth. He couldn't keep burning money like this without earning income or seeing a return. Things were getting tight. On Staten Island, Matera went to his internist, who warned that his blood pressure was dangerously high. When Garcia Alaconte called from Santo Domingo to tell Matera there was talk of more treasure hunters descending on Cayo Levantado in search of the Golden Fleece, Matera didn't even ask questions. Carolina flew in a few days later to spend time with her fiancé. To her, Matera looked more than just tired. He looked beaten. When she asked how he was doing with things, with Tracy, the Golden Fleece, John Chatterton, he told her a story. To hone his diving skills while in high school, he took jobs cleaning and changing propellers on boats at Great Kills Harbor, the nicest marina on Staten Island. The work sometimes required him to stay underwater for hours at a time, but the pay was good and the water shallow. One Saturday, while cleaning the last boat, he glanced at the air gauges for his tanks and saw only 500 pounds of air remaining, about 18 minutes worth. Not much, but enough to finish the job. He kept scrubbing, dreaming of ways to spend the $400 he would clear that day, a king's ransom in 1980. Suddenly, shards of pain shot through his left arm and into his head, a burning so hot it buckled his knees. He jerked away, but his arm wouldn't move. A rusty 2-inch bluefish hook had plunged all the way into his wrist. Blood flowed into the water, making ribbons of brown. Matera knew better than to pull again. The hook was tied to fishing line tangled around the propeller. So he reached for a knife to cut himself free. But no matter how hard he worked, the line wouldn't give, and he realized then that it was made not of monofilament, but of stainless steel, used by fishermen to stop sharks and bluefish from biting clear through. He checked his air. At this rate, he had just a minute or two left to breathe. He looked up toward the surface. He was less than a foot underwater, yet could not move any higher. He tried to ease the hook out of his wrist, but the barbs on its shank had anchored next to a vein, and he dared not pull it farther. He checked his tanks again, near empty. Now, he had to make a decision. He could rip the barbed hook out of his wrist, or he could use his remaining few breaths to try to untangle the line. If he chose the former, he might bleed to death. If he chose the latter, he risked running out of air and drowning, just inches from the surface. Matera grabbed the hook in his right hand, took a final, deep breath, and pulled as hard as he could. Skin and veins tore, and the water exploded red around him. Now free, he kicked to the surface, throwing off his mask and regulator and gulping air. Bystanders converged, throwing him towels and offering to drive him to the hospital, but, immortal at 17, he assured them he was okay.
"Listen to me, honey," a woman said. "If you've ever trusted anyone in your life, trust me now. You're gonna bleed to death if you don't go to the hospital. You have to go."
He took a towel, wrapped it around his wrist, and ran to his car. At Staten Island Hospital, with Matera still in his wetsuit, doctors cauterized the vein, gave him a tetanus shot, and told him he was lucky to be alive. That night, he bought two pairs of professional pruning shears, European models that could cut through anything, and he brought them to every dive he made after that, the deep and the shallow, the routine and the impossible. Matera fought a lump in his throat as he looked into Carolina's eyes.
"I'm drowning again," he said. "We're a week away from getting the Golden Fleece, but it's not happening. I'm inches from the surface, but I can't pull the hook out."
A few weeks later, in mid-February 2009, Chatterton and Matera agreed that they needed to talk. Both were headed back to the Dominican Republic, so they made a date for lunch the next week. In Samana, they set out for a restaurant about 15 kilometers down the road. Neither said much as Chatterton drove the white pickup truck through a street crowded with crooked houses, chicken coops, and hanging laundry. Every block or so, he weaved around an open manhole, the cover stolen and sold for scrap. From out of nowhere, a man riding a motorcycle pulled in front of the truck and began waving.
"Look at this guy," Chatterton said. "He's pissed."
"What did you do to him?" Matera asked.
"Nothing."
"You didn't cut him off, run over some chickens, flip him the finger?"
"Nothing."
The agitated rider swerved back and forth a few more times.
"Johnny's got a gun," Chatterton said.
Matera looked over. He could see the weapon, a nickel-plated Beretta 92. Expensive. To Matera, all this was bad news. Either the man was emotionally disturbed, or he was looking to rob two gringos who'd wandered out too far in the country. Drug smugglers lived in these parts, hidden in the hills. They would kill two rich-looking Americans without blinking. Matera unholstered his Glock 9mm.
"Keep him in front of us," Matera said. "Don't pass him or let him get to our flanks."
The biker began flailing his gun, screaming obscenities and demanding that Chatterton pass, but Chatterton wouldn't do it. The man slowed his bike to 20 miles per hour, then 15, bobbing and weaving, trying to slip behind the truck, but Chatterton slid with him, refusing the flank. It occurred now to Chatterton to stop, but he didn't know who else might be lying in wait. In a moving truck, at least, they had 3,000 pounds of momentum. The biker slowed to 5 miles per hour.
"Watch his hands," Matera said.
Driving only fast enough to keep the bike upright, the man now waved his pistol over his left shoulder, toward the truck. People crowded the street to take in the spectacle. Matera cracked open his passenger door and wedged his foot in the space, then pointed his Glock at the biker's torso.
"Stay behind him, I've got him framed."
"Give the word and I run him over,"
Chatterton said. Women screamed, children ran, barking dogs descended as the motorcycle inched forward at just 2 or 3 miles per hour, the white truck just 10 yards behind, guns drawn on both sides, the biker and Matera screaming at each other in Spanish, 1,000 obscenities as the men continued their crawl. Matera didn't want to shoot, especially near a crowd, but the guy was giving him less choice with each passing moment.
"Drop the gun now!" Chatterton yelled,
but the man kept waving his weapon and screaming. Matera's finger flexed alongside the trigger guard.
"If he points it at us, I'm going to drop him," said Matera.
"I'll hit the gas and finish him," Chatterton said.
The motorcycle stopped. Slowly the man got off the bike and stepped forward. This was Matera's best chance, but it would only be there for a fraction of a second. He carried baggage from things he'd done in his life. Just because killing was justified didn't mean it was easy to live with. He had the tactical advantage here, the protection of his truck, and the enemy in front of him. And how would they explain this to police? He'd seen guys die for thinking things over too long, and now Chatterton revved the engine.
"Pon tus malditas manos en tu cabeza,"
Matera yelled.
"Put your fucking hands on your head."
Slowly, the man tucked the gun into the back of his pants. Spinning around, he ran back to his bike, gave a half salute, then drove off the road and up into the mountains, dirt and dust flying from his wheels. A moment later, he had disappeared. For a minute, Chatterton and Matera drove in silence. Then one of them said, "Man, we were good." And the other said, "Hell yeah, we were." Chapter 16. The Battle. In a booth at the restaurant, the men replayed their showdown with the motorcycle desperado. They'd intended to use the time to address the obvious, that things weren't working out for them. But neither had the heart to think about quitting on the other on a day when they'd had an adventure like this. The partners didn't see each other for several days after that. Then Chatterton called and told Matera it was time to talk. They met at the villa and sat on the veranda, holding sweating cans of diet soda, each waiting for the other to quit.
"Give me 3 days," Matera said. "I have one more idea."
The men looked over the channel toward Cayo Vigia.
"I thought we might be done," Chatterton said.
"We might be," Matera replied, "but not yet."
A few days later, Matera was on a flight bound for New York. On airplane tray tables, he usually balanced 3 or 4 books, a notebook and pens, and a snack. This time, he just looked out the window, nothing in front of him, watching the ocean pass below. In Manhattan, Matera pushed into the stacks of the New York Public Library on 42nd Street, pulling out as many volumes on 17th-century naval warfare and weapons as he could find. None made mention of the Royal Navy's engagement with Bannister, but if taken together, they could be assembled into a picture of the battle, an accounting that put Matera into the throat of the fight. He took notes on it all, searching for clues in the rubble. By his previous research, Matera already knew how things started. Acting on orders from the governor of Jamaica, 2 Royal Navy frigates, the Falcon and the Drake, sailed into Samana Bay to catch the pirate captain Joseph Bannister and destroy the Golden Fleece. The Navy captains expected to find the ship on the careen, being cleaned of barnacles and other sea growth, as she lay beached on her side at an island. Matera had always believed the advantage to lie with the Navy. The frigates could carry 58 cannons between them, the Falcon 42, the Drake 16, while Bannister had perhaps 30. But it wasn't until Matera opened his books that he began to understand the extent of the Navy's upper hand. The frigates were designed to be nimble and quick, lie low in the water, and carry heavy guns. They also happened to be beautiful, with sleek and muscled lines, the hunting dogs of the English fleet. The largest of them, like the Falcon, was powerful enough to fight in the line among England's mightiest warships. Between them, the Falcon and the Drake carried about 250 men, at least double the size of Bannister's crew. In addition to agility and speed, these three-masted frigates cut imposing figures. The Falcon was about 130 feet long, the Drake about 125. Massive ships for a Caribbean deployment. The Golden Fleece, at a length of perhaps 100 feet, was a baby by comparison. By size alone, the frigates carried a statement of intent from the governor of Jamaica. The Golden Fleece was going to be destroyed and Bannister was going to die. But the advantage only began with the ships. While pirates aboard the Golden Fleece probably had rare occasion to fire their cannons, gunners aboard the frigates practiced constantly. The Navy captains Charles Talbot of the Falcon and Thomas Spragg of the Drake were military commanders trained in the art of war. Bannister, by contrast, had been a merchant captain trained in the art of moving hides and dried meat. In terms of provisions, weapons, and ammunition, the Navy ships were much better supplied. Best of all for the frigates, Bannister was pinned down on an island. Pirates often were best at running, but there was nowhere for Bannister to go. Matera, however, had thought enough about tactics and conflict during his career in security to know that the pirates had advantages of their own. Bannister had placed two cannon batteries on the island, one of 10 guns and the other of 6, and no doubt had hidden them behind trees and in bunkers of logs or mud or sand, making it difficult for the Navy to see his men or hit his guns. They would be firing their weapons from an elevated position on land, not the pitching and rolling decks of a ship. The pirates would be fighting for their lives, always a strong motivator. Most of all, they were being led by Joseph Bannister, a man who'd already proved he could pull off the impossible by cheating the hangman and re-stealing his ship at Port Royal. Delving further into the books on his table, Matera could see how the battle must have unfolded. The frigates would have sailed into Samana Bay on the prevailing wind, hugging the peninsula along the northern shore, the only area deep enough and sufficiently free of reefs to allow safe passage for ships so large. With a stiff wind, they might have made 9 or 10 knots, 10 or 11 miles per hour, their red ensigns flying in the breeze at the sterns. The Union Jack, like the modern British flag but without the red Irish diagonal stripe, hoisted on the bowsprit over the bow. Entering the channel near Cayo Vigia, where Chatterton and Matera believed the engagement occurred, the frigates would have been prepared for action, their gun decks cleared of tables, hammocks, and other tools of life at sea. At mid-afternoon, they would have been less than a mile from the Golden Fleece, but still wouldn't have seen her. Tucked into a crook in the island, the pirate ship was invisible to all but those who came close enough to be ambushed. By now, pirate lookouts would have sounded the alarm and Bannister would have ordered gunners to their stations. Some of them manned cannons, others muskets. The only question was when to fire on the Navy ships. The frigates drew closer, to within a quarter mile of the Golden Fleece. At this point it was unlikely that Bannister had gotten his ship off the careen and back into the water, but it would have been too late to matter either way. Sailing into the channel, Navy lookouts would have spotted the pirates through their telescopes, and the pirates would have known they'd been seen. It was impossible for Matera to know exactly what happened next. If he were Bannister, and he knew they thought alike, he would have fired on the frigates at this point, aiming for their bows, which were less well protected than their sides. Whether Bannister did this, or rather allowed the frigates to move in closer to give his gun crews a better shot, one thing was certain. The two sides were no more than 500 yards from each other, and the distance was closing fast. Now, the Navy captains had to decide how close to get to the pirates before they committed to fight. There was risk and reward no matter which way they played it. Cannons were not accurate in the 1680s, especially at distances of more than a few hundred yards. Most often they didn't need to be. Warring ships of the age commonly battered each other from point-blank range, which might be as close as 50 feet. Sometimes they didn't fire until they saw the buckles on the enemy's shoes, and that was not just an expression. Shooting cannons at a distance was especially difficult. Gunpowder was inconsistent in both quality and quantity from shot to shot, which affected the speed at which the ball left the muzzle and, therefore, the gunner's ability to fire with precision. Cannonballs were made about a quarter inch smaller than the diameter of the bore, to assure that they didn't jam during discharge and blow up the gun. That meant the ball bounced off the sides